Thank you, Richard. Now, Forrest MacDonald and the institution of the presidency in American foreign policy.
Like Richard, David, I would like to thank you for those kind words. I once was told that Bill Buckley, upon being introduced on some occasion, got up and said, "Thank you very much for your flattering introduction," which did not do me justice. You went a little too far, I think, but what the heck. The framers of the Constitution expected the President and the Senate to be more or less equal partners in the conduct of American relations with other nations. But that expectation was dashed almost at the outset. Only a few months after George Washington became president, he and Secretary of War Henry Knox, taking the advise and consent provision of the Constitution clause literally, dropped in on the Senate one Saturday morning without warning to seek advice concerning some pending Indian negotiations, and the result was a fiasco. Thenceforth, presidents declined to seek the Senate's formal advice in advance of negotiations. Instead, they or their envoys negotiated, and if a treaty resulted, sent it to the Senate for consent, but not for advice. As the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations put it, as early as 1816, it was well established that the president is, quote, "the sole organ of the nation in its external relations and its sole representative with foreign nations." Now, between the presidency of James Monroe and that of William McKinley, the manner in which foreign relations were conducted was of little consequence, for such relations were minimal. To be sure, the United States was not totally isolated from the rest of the planet. Economically, it was integrated into a world order. A bumper crop on the Danube or the Volga, for instance, could spell disaster for wheat farmers in the Middle West. But in the formal nation-to-nation sphere, we simply had not much to do with the rest of the world. Only James K. Polk, who maneuvered the country into a war of territorial aggrandizement against Mexico, and Millard Fillmore, who opened Japan to American trade, had any appreciable influence on international affairs. The rise of the United States as a world power, dramatically symbolized by the Spanish-American War, and even more so by American intervention in World War I, ended that happy state of affairs and necessitated some constitutional adjustments that would inevitably elicit controversy. The first such change concerned the scope of the treaty-making power. Article 6 of the Constitution makes the Constitution, laws passed in pursuance of it, and, quote, "all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, the supreme law of the land." Now, early in the 20th century, Congress passed a law regulating the killing of migratory game birds, mainly Canadian geese. The act was contested, and the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional on the ground that Congress had been delegated no power to legislate on such matters. But then President Taft negotiated a treaty with Canada, agreeing that both countries would regulate such birds, and Congress repassed the same act. This time, in the case of Missouri v. Holland, the Supreme Court upheld the legislation on the ground that the treaty was a part of the supreme law of the land. In other words, a treaty can give constitutional sanction to an action that is otherwise impermissible. The next step was taken in the 1930s, when, in the case of United States versus Curtis Wright Export Corporation, the Supreme Court ruled that executive agreements, that is to say, for example, an agreement between the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of another country, had the legal force of a treaty. The combined implication from the two cases was that the President could bargain away all or any part of the Constitution. Indeed, by the 1933 Litvinov Agreement, Franklin Roosevelt agreed to seize and return to the Soviet Union property of Russian emigres who had become American citizens. He did so, and in U.S. v. Belmont and U.S. v. Pink, decided in 1937 and 42, respectively, the court upheld these confiscations in spite of the due process and just compensation clauses of the Fifth Amendment. Verily, the president now had a blank check in the conduct of foreign relations. After World War II, a strong reaction against the perceived abuses of executive power set in. The adoption in 1951 of the 22nd Amendment, limiting presidents to two terms, was a part of that reaction. More to our point is that the amendment proposed by Republican Senator John Bricker of Ohio early in 1952. The Bricker Amendment had three sections. One, that treaties conflicting with the Constitution should be void. Two, that treaties should become effective as domestic law only through legislation that would be constitutional in the absence of the treaty. And three, that Congress should have power to regulate executive agreements and that such agreements would be subject to the limitations on treaties in the second section. At first, Bricker received strong support, and in 1954, the amendment fell just one vote short of the necessary two-thirds majority in the Senate. As time passed, however, and as the much-trusted Eisenhower conducted foreign relations in a manner that most people considered acceptable, the amendment's appeal failed. And then, in a pair of decisions handed down in 1957, the Supreme Court rendered it moot by ruling, albeit ambiguously, that treaties are as subject to being declared unconstitutional as are acts of Congress. But the most dangerous, or vital, depending on one's point of view, of the president's powers derived not from treaty making, but from his role as commander-in-chief. Now, Congress has the exclusive authority to declare war, and Congress has exercised that authority with great restraint, five times in 212 years. The president, by contrast, can deploy the nation's armed forces anywhere and at any time he pleases. One might suppose that he is restricted by Congress's power of the purse, but in practice, Congress has been extremely loath to interfere when troops are placed in danger. My favorite example of this concerned Teddy Roosevelt, who sent the Great White Fleet, so-called, on the round-the-world cruise despite Congress's refusal to appropriate the necessary funds. He said, in effect, to his admirals that if they got to the Western Pacific and ran out of fuel, Congress would come through with the money, which, in fact, it did. Now, we're all familiar with the Korean and Vietnamese conflicts, bloody and costly ventures fought without a declaration of war. But most people assume that those were exceptional cases. They assume wrongly. Starting with Jefferson and Madison, presidents have repeatedly deployed the military in alien lands without congressional authorization and often without congressional approval before or after the fact, a total of more than 200 times. Most of these military operations were relatively small and could be justified by some law or another. About a third involved invasions of Latin American countries to protect the lives or property of United States citizens. Some were retaliatory attacks on remote Pacific peoples who lacked formal governments, and some were raids to interdict smugglers or slave traders. A number, however, were large-scale affairs, including the seven times the United States invaded Japan in the 1850s and 1860s, and the war to suppress the Aguinaldo Rebellion in the Philippines, which lasted 4 years, during which 126,000 American troops saw action and 200,000 Filipinos were killed. Teddy Roosevelt sent troops into action in Honduras, the Dominican Republic, Syria, Abyssinia, Morocco, Korea, and Cuba. Woodrow Wilson deplored Roosevelt's actions, but once in office, he also intervened in the Caribbean republics, invaded Mexico four times, and sent more than 12,000 soldiers into the Soviet Union as a part of a joint Allied force. All this was done without congressional authorization. In reaction against the imperial presidencies of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, Congress attempted in the 1970s to handcuff the president regarding foreign affairs. In the summer of 1973, it began to cut off funds for military activities in Southeast Asia, thus ensuring the subsequent slaughter of millions. Then in November, Congress passed, over Nixon's veto, the War Powers Resolution, designed to make future armed ventures the joint responsibility of Congress and the White House. The resolution stipulated that, quote, in every possible instance, the President must consult with Congress before sending American forces into hostilities or into situations where imminent involvement in hostilities is clearly indicated. If in the absence of a declaration of war, the President should send troops into hostile situations or enlarge combat forces where they were already stationed, he was required to notify Congress within 48 hours, and if Congress did not vote to approve the deployment, the forces must be withdrawn in 60 days. As a gesture, the War Powers Resolution may have been a wholesome corrective to abuses of presidential power, but as a practical matter, it was ineffectual. Every president from Gerald Ford through the first George Bush took the position that it was unconstitutional and acted more or less as if it did not exist. As for Bill Clinton, when he launched his tail wags dog raids on an aspirin factory in the Sudan and an empty terrorist camp in Afghanistan, plus his bogus war to save Kosovo from the Serbs, he wantonly ignored the War Powers Resolution. Many critics saw through his ploy, but almost no one in government protested that he had exceeded his authority. One is justified in asking whether, in the absence of restraints by either the Congress or the courts, there are any barriers to the President simply doing as he pleases in conducting foreign relations. The only limit I can think of is the power of public opinion, and that, though real, is problematical. Except for the lunatic left, which is concentrated in academia and the media, of course, Americans are a patriotic people who prefer to believe that whatever we do in relation to other nations is for the best. They can also see and comprehend what is happening worldwide, even when the media distort or decline to report the news. Thus, for example, they understood that Ronald Reagan's foreign policy was masterful, and that he, in fact, won the Cold War with the Soviet Union, as, by the way, did most Europeans, though the media reported that monumental triumph as if Reagan had had nothing to do with it. And yet, most Americans really don't care much about what happens elsewhere in the world, even if our armed forces are off shooting or bombing somebody. They become seriously interested. Less of a break on overseas adventuring than it once did. On the other hand, our tolerance level has been lowered immensely, and I do not believe it would require a great deal of inconvenience to get people out in the streets in protest. When people took to the streets during the Vietnamese conflict, older Americans were surprised, having been lulled by the relative unanimity of World War II, into believing that Americans don't do that sort of thing. They forgot that during every other declared war in American history, large segments of the population seriously objected and did what they could to sabotage the war effort. In other words, Americans do that sort of thing, and they're capable of doing it again. And on balance, I think that presidential administrations have more to fear from the people than the people have to fear from misguided, unchecked presidential power. What of the future? History suggests that a 21st century president needs to articulate a coherent and restrained foreign policy that is clearly in the national interest, which he can then implement with the support of the American people. Whether that will happen is, of course, anybody's guess. Thank you.